I guess you could use, maybe, in fact, I think an easy way would do it is to combine both. Likely use a, you know, pipe and a base, let's say for 20 meters, because you did ask about a 20 meters, it's doable. So if you took a piece of a pipe, say about, 20-foot piece of pipe, and then used a piece of pipe, in other words, taper it up to about 30-some-odd feet, and then set it on the bottom with a network. I guess you can put together, all you need is, most likely, like you say, some kind of a simple network, a series coil and a capacitor across it, and should be able to tune it fairly easy. I would assume that the pipe can be a tapering pipe. I don't think it would have any effect tapering it up, in fact, up to a whip eventually up on top of it to reduce the drag over.
Well, there's multiple ways now you can build this half-wave vertical antenna. If you've got, let's say, for instance, you're doing this on 40 meters, where the half-wave dipole is 63 feet long, I think it is, 67 feet long. As long as you've got a tree that's 67 feet tall, you've got it made. If you've got a radio tower that's 67 feet tall, you've got it made. At first, you're going to think that the half-wave dipole lying parallel to a metallic support is going to give you an interference and a blockage in one direction. If that metallic support is not a resonant length, it is essentially transparent. It's not there. And if you're worried about the metallic support giving you a blockage in that direction, there's nothing magic about the dipole being completely vertical. You can pull the bottom out away from the base of the support a little bit so it becomes a sloper antenna. So, various ways you can support vertically a 67-foot long half-wave dipole if you didn't shrink it down mechanically by way of loading coils, zigzagging, and top-loading capacitor hats on the ends. The vertical support itself could become the antenna. Now, to be a half-wave vertical antenna, you really would like to put an insulator at the bottom, and that represents a mechanical engineering problem. Few of us will set up a 70 feet of tower with a great big porcelain insulator at the bottom of the tower. And half-wave, you can't ground the bottom and really feed it in the half-wave manner. So it's got to be ungrounded if it is the radiating system. When you talked about tapered pipes, Mel, I guess you're talking about the tapered pipe being the radiator itself, as well as being half-wave long. And there's impedance matching. Let me drop. There's impedance matching device at the bottom. Could be a tapped coil, very similar to what you'll see inside of a 5/8 wave antenna on your 2-meter mag mount for your car. And the bottom of that tapped coil will have to be grounded, but it doesn't require an elaborate ground or a whole lot of ground plane radials. One simple grounding rod in the ground would do the job beautifully, because you're feeding the end of the antenna that has a 2,000 ohm impedance, so very little grounding is required. Whereas a quarter wave ground plane, your base impedance is something in the vicinity of 30 ohms, and that's part of the reason why you need 32 ground plane radial wires to give you a proper counterpoise for that thing, because you're feeding a very low impedance. Here we're feeding something that is a few hundred times higher in impedance, and it's a lot easier to do. So that's the way I would do it, and guaranteed you'll get a lot of performance. A lot of the people you talk to will say, gee, tell me more, I've never heard about such an antenna. For reasons I don't understand, it's not popular. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right, you mentioned that the insulator on the bottom of a pole that's going to be 30-some-odd feet tall, let's say for 20 meters. If you have to put that into an insulator, if you were take a piece of PVC pipe that could slip in with a cap on the bottom of the PVC, and then stuck it into the ground, or if you needed a base, a concrete base and all, would that be a sufficient insulator, do you believe, Dick, over?
pipe of big enough diameter and big enough wall thickness. The insulator itself we're talking about, the main problem you've got to worry about is mechanical strength. And I think you really should guide the structure, because if you're supporting it from the bottom with the PVC pipe, a PVC pipe doesn't have a hell of a lot of rigidity to it for making a cantilever support. So the bottom insulator, being a Coke bottle or a piece of PVC pipe, would work like a charm as long as the structure itself is guide. But a half-wave structure does require high voltage on the ends, therefore the ends have to be insulated. Quarter-wave structure, no, you don't need that, but now you need really fancy ground plane radials. Half-wave vertical has got to be given more emphasis. And by the way, when it comes to the impedance matching, if you fed the bottom of the half-wave vertical with open wire 600-ohm line and the right kind of an antenna tuner, impedance matching would become automatic. You wouldn't need to put a tapped coil at the bottom of the structure. But you got multiple ways of doing it. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Very interesting. Okay, this is K2KEY. Now, the only reason I said piece of, I was thinking of something like that, a base like that, and I thought if you put PVC and then you wanted a base, solid base, if you then were to, you know, put it into then like a pail, and fill the pail with, well, I guess you could put cement in the pail and have that as your base, you know, and then drop the pail even into a hole in the ground. In other words, so that you could have a solid base. Of course, you still would guy it and all, but, you know, just to develop a good solid base, I guess it's all doable. So, you know, that's a very neglected, like you say, way to go with the vertical. Instead of a quarter wave vertical, for the problem of laying radials, which I am very familiar with, but of course, for this would be for 80 meters a half wave vertical for 80 meters. That's getting a little bit on the tough side to do, unless, like you say, do it with just dropping a wire down if you have a support that high. That it go up like 125 feet, you know, and drop it straight down. But that's, like I say, not too common around here. But for higher frequencies, I guess it sounds like it may be a very viable antenna, Dick. Over.
Just need a Ginkgo tree like mine.
Yeah, there are some people, like these guys in Yonkers, have got some very tall trees. And even if you wanted to build an 80-meter vertical dipole, it would be nice if the tree was 130 feet tall. But even if the tree is not, if the tree is only 100 or 90 feet tall, that would mean you take the base of the half-wave dipole and pull it away from the base of your support structure, and it becomes a sloper antenna. There's nothing magic about purely vertical. Slanting a little bit off to one side still works like a charm. But the nice thing about a vertical antenna in general is that the reflection off the ground doesn't give you the normal kind of a phase angle that you get with horizontal. The reflected signal off the ground gives you a 180-degree phase reversal, and that's the mechanism by which a horizontal dipole above the ground acts like there's a real dipole above the ground and a mirror image of one below the ground, but unfortunately the mirror image of the one below the ground is out of phase if it's horizontal. That creates an interferometry pattern that in elevation gives you a null on the horizon and a peak some significant number of degrees above the horizon, depending on the altitude of your antenna. Whereas with vertical, the way the reflection off the ground works, you don't get a null on the horizon. In general, a vertical antenna gives you a much lower angle of radiation. And if your particular vertical is full half wave above the ground, that means the phase center of your radiation is further, higher up in altitude, giving you better clearance of the nearby hills and buildings. And so for two or three reasons, you're going to get a lot more performance. Low angle of radiation, higher altitude of phase center, no phase reversal on ground reflection. And the only slight disadvantage is the unorthodox way of feeding the bottom, where it is approximately 2,000 ohm impedance. But once you get past that very simple unusual characteristic, it can be a 99% efficient antenna, as I see it, with essentially no ground plane radials. It's time more of us do it. Each time you and I hear somebody on the air who's used a sloper, they usually say awfully pleasant things about them. I bet you've heard that a few times, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yes, I have, and I used one on 30 meters and it worked like a house of fire. That's the only way I can describe it. I have worked everything I've heard on 30 meters with 150 watts, which is the highest power that you are permitted on 30 meters. So no problem using that antenna, except I don't know if you're going completely, you know, you talk about a sloper that people picture just basically an antenna sloping down. But I found, if you remember through experiments, that it sort of looked like a concave type of antenna where it drops down vertically a good part of it, and the bottom sort of starts to curve outward. Through experimentation, for some reason, what that is doing to change the pattern, at least in my case, Dick, it makes for a very effective antenna. I work into Europe and all really extremely well, and it was a lot of times pulling it up and down with the pulley system that I had from the radio room. What a mess that was. But that experiment was an interesting experiment, and I don't know really, is it combination because it's somewhat vertical and then makes that angle with the ground? The other half of it, is that what is changing the pattern to some kind of extent that's making it an over-effective radiator? I'm not really sure, Dick, what's taking place except what the finished product works, how it works over.
I've got some guesses here, Mel. A pure vertical antenna has a pattern that is 360 degrees in azimuth, identical in all compass headings, and as you curve the bottom in your parabolic manner, you're only curving the bottom one-third. You're only curving the high voltage section of the antenna. The center is still nearly vertical. And most of the antenna modeling programs look at the current of each little segment of the antenna, figure out what magnetic field that creates, add up all those little segments in order to figure out the antenna pattern. That would lead you to believe the high current area of the antenna does the majority of the radiating. That may not be completely true, but at least that's the way the modeling programs work, and they come up with the right answers. As such, that only the bottom third, which has the higher voltage, lower current area, is the part that you've got as a parabolic shaped thing because of the way it slopes and the line goes slack. I think the difference in pattern is fairly minor. I didn't say zero, but I don't think it's a big difference in azimuthal pattern because of that parabolic bottom. I'll bet you if I compared the antenna pattern of a pure vertical versus yours, I think the difference wouldn't be a whole lot. That's a guess on my part, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Like I say, this was a very interesting experiment, and basically I had it, you know, my favorite tree out front that's got more antennas hooked to it. I'm surprised it don't light up that tree by itself when I'm on the air. But the antenna comes down from that tree, drops a good distance down the first section, pretty much almost quite tilted out. Not very much, but almost like you say, vertical. And then as it makes that bottom curve. Now, what I did with that, I had down on the bottom, I had the pulley and on the bottom of the antenna, I had a lead weight. I had this cord, this fish cord, pulled back up to the shack, which is on the second floor. And I was able to let out or pull up. And I wanted to see for myself, what is the difference if I go from vertical and work my way up to the pure, you know, horizontal point, because that's the other support. I could pull it up and actually make it into a horizontal dipole. And when I was letting it out, I was, in fact, to evaluate, really, you know, to nitpick it and really see the evaluation. I wasn't going to try to look at the S meter. I have a scope. An old scope that I happen to have. Let me let it drop for a minute. have an old scope, an old 5-inch scope. I pulled the original CRT out, the 5-AP1, the 6-inch valve, whatever the heck it was. And I put in a T7 CRT, which had a number of them around from fooling around with flow scans. You know, the longer persistence phosphor. So that way I can see, you know, the actually look at the signals rather on an S meter, look at it just coming off the audio at the peak on 30 meters. And I could actually then really, you know, watch the change in the peak of the signals. And moving that antenna with the cord through the window up and down, watching the scope, that's where I found the optimum point, Dick, where this antenna performs. And that's where I eventually left it. All I can say, it works phenomenally well, over.
As you were pulling that cord where your sloper went from almost vertical to almost horizontal, was the standing wave ratio changing? Probably a little bit, but my guess is you were retuning it with your antenna tuner, therefore you were always putting the same power into it. Now the biggest variable is, what direction is the guy you're talking to? I think you'll get one kind of performance when you're talking to a guy in Philadelphia, another kind of performance when you're talking to a guy in London. And maybe you saw, if you were on a day where you're talking to both of those guys and they both came up at the same rate as you went to this parabolic shape. Give me a few more words on that, Mel. First of all, was there a change in the visuar as you changed the tilt? K2KEY, K2RIW?
Well, to negate that as a factor, I was using an ATU. This rig I was using it on has a built-in automatic tuner. You can hear the servos constantly changing in it. And I was basically looking for a DX antenna, 30 meters. It's got a fairly good range on it. The base, when it's open, that it is a combination between 40 and 20 meters. So it is quite a great band, all CW, of course, and not a very big band. And I did this over a period of days. This was not a one-shot afternoon situation. Weather was warm. I was alone here. I was have the peace of mind that I could do some experiments, not too often. You know, and I'm not saying I'm getting a dirty look already, but it's just that I could, you know, do some work, really concentrate on what I was doing. So I evaluated it with a number of stations, you know, coming in from Europe, some from South America, and they seem to all fall into the same category as this one particular way that the antenna happens to fall at that point where it seems to work the best, Dick, over.
Yeah, I'm wondering, as you go from horizontal to vertical, you are, by quite a bit, changing the center of radiation of the antenna altitude above the ground. That is therefore changing your takeoff angle to the ionosphere. And depending on the status of the ionosphere on that nice warm summer day when you're doing this experiment, there's an ideal takeoff angle that would give you the strongest bounce off the ionosphere and the best signals into South America. That's the guys you were listening to. I am curious if you did that experiment in the summer and then duplicated it in the winter, would you get the same results? Someday you'll have to try that again, Mel. Or maybe you already did that. Back to you.
No, really. It would be a little difficult to do it, you know, cold weather and all, but I'm so satisfied with the results that I wouldn't want to change anything because it seems to work with this way it is, this shape it is. It seems to work equally as well with Europe and South America, you know, two opposite directions, really, two actually almost right angles to each other. And the feed point, no, the feed point, basically, yeah, it moves out a little bit. It's almost still almost vertical, the top piece of it, Dick. It tilts out maybe 20, 25 degrees out, and then the bottom actually makes that U. It only comes down to about 12 degrees if you look at ground level, you know, where that makes that curve, and that's it. But it surely was a better... It surely performs better than if it was pure vertical or a sloper or a dipole. In other words, this seems to be the best of all those three possibilities. Over.
What what's your guess as to how many feet out from the bottom of the support structure is your point of attachment at the lowest part of the antenna, the parabolic curve? And I think you said this is a 30-meter antenna. Or is it a lower frequency antenna? Over to you, Mel.
The 30 meters, 10 megahertz, and 10 points, starts at 10-100, and goes to, well, actually, the only really operations you hear on it is between 10-100 and 10-150. Everything is sort of over there. Not a very busy band. It seems to be neglected mostly. From the support of the tree out to that, you know, the other support is a very convenient sign that I have there that says no parking anytime. That's my tie-off point. So that's about, with the piece I added up, it's about 12 feet, 12 feet high, I think I remember, 12 feet high. And that from the base of the tree is about, maybe about 20 feet thick over.
So I'm going to guess that the whole antenna is around 45 feet long, and you've got the base of it, I think you said 20 feet out. So, yep, I do see a fairly significant parabolic curve there, if I've got the numbers approximately right. And the top support, is it almost 45 feet up in the tree?
Somewhere in that neighborhood. I don't remember wherever I have to pull it up to. Everything works out at this point, you know. And it's, yeah, a pulley. I've got a pulley up there with the cord that comes down so I can, I got this all on pulleys and cords in the tree so I can raise and lower. The tree became a very great way of experimenting with wire antennas. You know, this is one of these big spruce trees that, you know, those evergreens. And it's a strong attack. It's a big one. This one is about, right now, I think it's approaching 70 feet tall. And I've climbed it, and it's really at the base, you know, tree at the base is, oh boy, it's about a foot, over a foot in diameter at the base. So it's quite a tree. And it makes tremendous support, Dick, for it, because it's, you know, the way the branches are laid out, you can easily, you know, put things, climb it, or, and put pulleys and everything out on those sturdy branches. So if anyone has I recommend that. It's a terrific tree for antenna experiments, over.
And all of your ropes that go over those pulleys, is that the ultraviolet protected black-colored Dacron rope? Go ahead.
I bought it at the Hamfest. They had a roll of it, 250 foot that time. I forgot what it was. That black Dacron rope with that that ultraviolet roof and all. Very strong stuff, and of course easy to, you know, to tie and to cut. Very easy to cut it with the right tool. That's the whole idea, you know, not to fray it up, but. I found a very good way of cutting it and everything, so it works out quite well, to tell you the truth. You can raise and lower these wire antennas, and a lot of fun to experiment with them, over.
Do you cut your Dacron rope with a soldering gun or a soldering iron so that you're melting and cutting at the same time, so that the cut end doesn't fray?
Actually, I've got a hot cutter. It's a gadget for cutting that stuff. Somebody gave me one of them that they use it commercially somewhere. He says, you plug this thing in, and they got two versions. I understand they got a battery version now, and you, it's a strange looking thing. It's like a curved knife that sort of turns. It's, in other words, the knife like pivots. It's specially made for cutting the type of material used for cutting any polypropylene ropes. It's used in places where people, you know, use polypropylene ropes and this type of stuff for pulling cables, over.
Sounds like a fun tool. The way that knife curves, does it supply sort of a circular slicing action as it's hot and cutting into the Dacron?
if you look at it, it's like the housing of it is like a U, like a question mark, I would say, like a question mark. And picture the blade inside that, the curved part. So as you pull it, like the blade sort of curves up against that, it has a slot in that portion of it, and it gets hot. That the blade area gets hot, Dick, and it just slices through it and makes like a sealed edge at the same time, over.
So it sounds like you get a nice square cut with it completely melted and sealed off across that square cut, and no fraying takes place in the future.
Exactly. Like I say, it's a big one. It's made to be able to take a piece of polypropylene rope that's about, I guess up to a half inch in diameter. So this stuff I'm using is quarter inch. I'm using the quarter inch stuff. They had 5/16 there. They had a quarter. I think they have 8. They got a whole bunch of that different types of stuff always at the hamvention. In fact, are you planning on going to the hamvention next Sunday, over?
Yeah, I think I will. And your actual polypropylene black rope, is it braided somewhat like clothesline?
So the outside is smooth. It's black. It's a black, you know, sleeve with inside reinforced with fiberglass, I believe, though, whatever it is. That's the way it comes. In fact, if you go there, you'll see they have rolls of it. Definitely got 100-foot tanks. We've got rolls of it, 250, 500, different size, different diameter, and all. It's a whole pile of it there, Dick. Over.
Is this stuff called parachute cord?
Yeah, I don't know what the ice is. I only understand it as black. I think, what they call it? I think they call it black dacron. I think that was the name on the roll. I think it says black dacron, over.
Now, I bought some black dacron braided rope from Turnpike Marine more than 20 years ago. There's a great big heavy branch on a tree out in front of my house that broke, and it snapped in a funny way, but I didn't want to sacrifice it. So I roped that branch back up with this dacron rope 20 years ago, and it's still supporting that branch. I wouldn't be a bit surprised to find there's a 150-pound tension on that quarter-inch diameter rope, and it has held it all these years.
I've done something similar in the backyard also. I have a tree in the backyard, and one of the big branches started to break away just for the weight of it. And there's another one right adjacent to it, and I jacked it. Actually used a jack, pushed it back up with an extension piece of 2x4, got it back in, and then tied it off with the half-inch stuff. But this stuff has a very smooth jacket. It's not braided out. You know where there's no braid. Inside is like, I guess the only way to describe it is looks like a lot of filaments of glass filaments inside the sleeve, Dick, over.
Yeah, except for the fact that you say that the outer sheath is smooth. If the outer sheath had been braided and then strands inside, that is a kind of mountaineering rope that's called Kern mantle rope. Very strong stuff. Right, back to you, Mel.
Like I say, next week if you're there at the line mark, you'll see a table of the guy usually shows up, sells that stuff. So if you're looking for any of it, it's great for antenna work and going over the pulleys nice and smooth. Everything is really working quite well. I've had that there up also for many years. I have a lot of pulleys. I have a lot of support. You know, I'll pull up the loop antennas and the big loop and these things and all. So I've used a lot of it, Dick. I've got a lot of support and a lot of wire antennas of all kinds up there. I could say done quite a bit of experimenting over the years with, of course, wire antennas especially. So I know exactly, you know, what they're capable of doing and lasting a long, long time. If put upright, your antennas really can stay up a long time. It's amazing because I've gone through a lot of wind and things here. And so far, haven't had any real trouble, Dick. Over.
Now, this storm that's coming to us tonight, Mel, is coming from the west. Has your daughter mention whether or not it started snowing at her house yet?
Said a little flakes are coming down there in New Jersey and Montclair, but nothing's heavy as of yet, so I don't think we're going to get the brunt of the storm maybe till during the wee hours of the night. We'll see. It depends on, I guess, the wind, basically, how the wind pushes it all along the coast here or whatever, whether it will get a substantial amount of snow. All right. Would like to go for one more? I'll try one more, Dick.
Go for it.
Okay. Here's one that's coming. We're talking about something similar. How does an ATU work? What does it actually do? This is a very popular item, of course, today. Automatic antenna tuners, the ATU. Automatic tuning units, what I believe they refer to it as. And how does it work? I got a number of those questions been coming in. I guess to bring it up. But being it's right in front of me now, we'll discuss ATU. Over.
Okay. The answer is it works quite well. The real magic began around 1968 or so, when Hewlett-Packard started measuring phase angles at radio frequencies, and they built something called a vector voltmeter. Pretty soon they built something called a vector network analyzer. Once you can measure phase angle of the signal that is flowing back from your antenna, and once you can measure the magnitude of the signal that flows back from your antenna, those two pieces of information can be plotted on a Smith chart, or it can be added to a mathematical formula, and you therefore know what is the impedance of the antenna, if you knew the length of the transmission line. But even if you don't know the length of the transmission line, exactly what impedance do you see at the input end of that transmission line is purely determined by the reflected signal, amplitude, and phase. So the antenna tuner contains the equivalent of a directional coupler measuring the amplitude and phase angle of that reflected signal, adjusting its servo motors accordingly to account for that impedance, to impedance match. In the simplest case, let me drop. If your antenna was giving you a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, because the antenna was a 25 ohm resistor instead of a 50 ohm resistor on a 50 ohm cable, that would be a 1/3 voltage ratio of reflection. Put 30 volts into the cable, and 10 volts will come back to you. 1/3 reflected voltage represents a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. And a 25 ohms is a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, as well as 100 ohms is a standing wave ratio. The difference is the phase angle. A 25 ohm load will give you a phase angle of reflected signal, 1/3 of the voltage that you apply, and 180 degrees of phase shift from input to output. Whereas a 100 ohm load will give you 0 degrees of phase shift and 1/3 the voltage reflected. Correspondingly, if you put a 50 ohm antenna in the end of your transmission line, no reflected signal would take place. So the smart of the mechanism in your antenna tuner is it looks at the amplitude and phase angle and adjusts its variable capacitors accordingly. If it adjusts those capacitors, and if it's a simple pi network, and if it makes the tuning and loading capacitor of the pi network, the input capacitor and the output capacitor, if it adjusts them to the right ratio, the network will give you a 50 ohm input impedance, a 25 ohm output impedance, and now you've got a perfect impedance match. That's one of the ways it could work. That's probably one of the best ways, but measuring that phase angle tells you which way to twist those capacitors if the circuit is smart enough. It's like a blind man walking up a hill. Your tilt of your feet tells you which way is uphill. Well, the phase angle of that reflected signal, I gave you the simple example of a purely resistive 25 ohm resistor as the load. Obviously, if you had some reactants in there, the phase angle would be a different, it wouldn't be 0 or 180 degrees, it would be 90 or 270 degrees. But still, the phase angle tells you what to do, and the machine is smart enough to do that, and so that the transmitter now sees a pure 50 ohm load input end of the antenna tuner. It's hard to believe that phase angle at these RF frequencies can be measured, but now it's repeater.
Time out.
But nowadays, a really well-made vector network analyzer can measure phase angle of a reflected signal way beyond 100 gigahertz of frequency. There's a French-made version of a vector network analyzer plug-in module that works all the way up to 300 gigahertz. So, phase angle can be measured. Sampling probes inside of the phase detecting circuit are what's used in vector network analyzers. It's a simple bridge network in the case of an automatic antenna tuner. They don't have to go anywhere near as elaborate as using a voltage sampling circuit. That's my understanding of automatic antenna tuners. Once in a while, an automatic antenna tuner, though, can be confused. And when that happens, usually you can solve the problem by putting another random length of cable in there. There's a certain magnitude of reflected signal at a certain phase angle, which sometimes will confuse the machine. It's a matter of the way it's designed. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Jim, this is K2KEY. Well, having homebrewed one, really, I got very fascinated when they started to show up ATUs, and there was a very good article. In fact, it was a couple of ran a couple of months about homebrewing a tuner, and I did manage to construct one. And, fascination of how it works, watching the little motors move the variables and the resistors, the rotary inductor around. And basically, what is really taking place, it's formed, actually you're looking for really two different things it's doing. It's actually looking to cancel out the reactants of the antenna system, and also providing either a resistive step up or step down to match the resistive component. And it does this by using either an equivalent, known as an equivalent series, and or a parallel combination, so that RF will equal plus or minus JX, or plus or minus JX over XP. I'm trying to remember the formulas now. XP and RP, the relationships of a thick. I think you know I'm being over.
Yeah, Motorola published a classic paper that tells you how to convert between series and parallel equivalent circuits. With a modern day handheld calculator like the Hewlett-Packard series, if I had, for instance, a 25-ohm series resistor and a 25-ohm series reactor, I would write down that impedance as 25, comma, J plus J25. Well, when you put that in parentheses inside of the input screen of a Hewlett-Packard calculator and simply press the 1 over X key, which inverts, it does the conversion all for you. It then gives you a brand new complex number, a real and a reactive component, which is now a parallel equivalent. And so the conversion, which is a fairly complicated complex equation, in other words, it's got imaginary numbers in it, I haven't got it memorized because it is so easy for me to do it on my handheld calculator. I don't have to memorize the equation anymore, because when you use the equation and you end up with the J term in the denominator, you have to go through a fairly complicated process to get the J's out of the denominator and get them up into the numerator, and to cancel out the ones in the denominator. It's a multi-step complex math problem, and it's so easy on a handheld modern-day calculator just to press the 1 over key, and there's the answer. So I'm doing those calculations every day with the impedance matching I have to do on the funny antennas that I'm working with every day. And that's the way I do it. That combined with the so-called Berkeley program. You just Google the word impedance match plus Berkeley, B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y, and you'll get the most beautiful graphic program you've ever seen in your life, where it asks you what is the resistive and reactive component of the impedance of your source signal, in other words, your transmitter or your signal generator, what is the resistive and reactive component of your load. You give it that four pieces of information, and you press calculate, and it immediately gives you 16, count them, 1-6 diagrams that will solve it. Simple L networks, simple pi networks, pi T networks, and whatever. And it gives you all...
Repeater, timeout.
That Berkeley program gives you all those values on that screen instantaneously. It doesn't give you one answer, it gives you 16 answers, and you choose the one that you like the most, because it's got the lowest values, the largest values, the easiest values, the ones that are in your junk box, the layout that you like, whatever. Whatever is your criteria. I usually use one of the first four L networks, because for the simple impedance matching I'm doing, where I want the lowest possible Q, it solves the problem. And a simple shunt reactor and a simple series reactor, and you've got an impedance match 98% of the time. And you lay those out with modern-day surface mount components, 0603, and the biggest problem is all the work you've got to do under a microscope to mount those printed circuit, mount those little devices on a printed circuit board and get them properly soldered down without the tiddlywink problem coming along. You can hold on to an 0603 surface mount component with your tweezers. If you're not real careful, the tweezers slip and the device will jump what seems like a mile. You better hope you've got more spares of that value, otherwise you're going to spend the next half hour on your hands and knees on the floor with a flashlight. Been there, done that. Ain't fun. End up with scuffed up knees on your clothes. K2KEY, K2RIW.
WS2N question.
Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I was wondering, you know, the antenna tune is, you know, you have all these motors turning inductors or turning variable capacitors. I wonder if anybody is working on, or maybe they have, done this electronically. You know, I think of my HT, you know, I hit my volume control button up or down. I'm not turning any volume controls anymore. There's no mechanical thing that I'm turning. My VFO on my Kenwood 440, turn that VFO. There's no belt inside turning a capacitor anymore. You know, it's all, everything's electronic nowadays. I wonder, because these components have to be so large or something, you know, couldn't they have, like, you know, dozens of capacitors, have some kind of switching network in there where everything's done automatically, where you don't have to have the motors in there turning this and turning that? I wonder if any, you know, if that's in the future, Dick, or the laws of physics, because everything is, you know, seems to be so big in that world of antenna tuning, it can't be done. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, you're saying in the future. The future is now. That does exist. A purely solid-state automatic antenna tuner on a couple of very rare pieces of electronics today does exist. That's the good news. The bad news is only done below the 1 watt level, roughly, for a bunch of very good reasons. I can make a variable capacitor with a so-called varector diode, a back bias diode, where I change the back bias voltage on the diode and it changes the amount of capacitance. And if I wanted to switch from three picofarad to 23 picofarad with a varector diode, that's easy. But that varector diode only works correctly if the voltage of RF across it is a couple of volts. You put 10 volts of swing across that varector diode, and now you've got a parametric amplifier that's making all kinds of frequency harmonics for you. So at the 1 watt level, purely solid state impedance matching can be done. At the 100 watt level, depending on the impedance of your particular antenna and its VSWR, that variable capacitor you've got, that air-space variable capacitor, might have RF voltage on it, well above 1,000 volts. You ain't going to put that into a varector diode, Paul. So at the 100-watt level, for all the impedances that we've got to match, it's got to be done with some pretty bulky components and air variable capacitors. You can't miniaturize that very easily. I wouldn't say it can't be done. There are techniques in which you could do it, but it would be extremely expensive. You and I wouldn't want to pay for it. WS2N for any further comments, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. I'm just thinking, you know, with all these space shots and airplanes, military, you know, they've got to be able to switch frequency to frequency. I mean, they're depending, their lives are depending on these motors turning and not hanging up or not quitting or, I don't know. I know it's a reliable system, you know, it's been around forever. If you look at the disk drives on, they don't have, on the Mars landers, they don't have any hard drives at all. There's no spinning anything like that. I mean, they depend on motors for operating the equipment, but not for something like that. You know, they just use flash memory and this and that. So, okay, I was just envisioning, you know, dozens of maybe big capacitors, you know, put on a PC board and having one chip, you know, switch between all of them or something of that nature. I know the inductors said that would be difficult. You'd have to have too many of them. At least maybe you could have done something like that with big capacitors. Just, you know, switch between dozens of capacitors for your different impedance. But I guess not. Okay, very good, Dick. Back to you.
Yeah, for the price that you and I are willing to pay for Paul, and for the power levels that we're going to run, 100 watts to 1,000 watts, it takes great big components to do it well. And don't knock the reliability of motors. Modern-day brushless DC motors, properly constructed, can have ridiculously high reliability. There's no brushes, no commutator. The only thing in there that can wear out is the bearing, and if that's well sealed, boy, can that last. The brushless DC motor that's turning some ridiculous number of RPM, 24/7, 365 days a year, 5 years in a row, that's in the hard drive of your computer. Some people never turn their computer off, and some of those hard drives run continuously. And that brushless DC motor hangs in there all that time. You take a look at the brushless DC motors that are used for powering radio-controlled, battery-operated model airplanes. My goodness, are those things compact and powerful. You can get 3,000-watt DC motors. I've seen them running a helicopter. And that motor is about 1.75 inches diameter and about 4 inches long, turning out 3,000 watts. That's around 4.5 or 5 horsepower. And it can do it for 15 solid minutes. And you watch that helicopter roar. It is really a sight to behold. And I watched one of those demonstrations that took place at the NEAT Fair, Northeast Aero Technology Fair, in Schwinhoppel, New York, last summer. The summer before last, one of those helicopters did go into an error of some kind and struck somebody in the crowd. And my goodness, is that a big, powerful machine, a very significant event. So brushless DC motors are here to stay, very reliable, don't knock them. It's the least expensive approach in many cases. But yes, when it comes to the 1 watt level and below, solid state automatic impedance matching can be done, a little bit pricey. Even there, you might be tempted to use very small brushless DC motors, servo motors. The servo motors that are used for controlling the control surfaces of modern day radio
repeater, timeout.
Those little servo motors that are used for controlling the control surfaces of modern day radio control model airplanes. Again, very, very reliable and work for very long periods of time. K2KEY, K2RIW, you got a bill.
This is K2KEY. Okay, sticking with ATU. First of all, yes, the stick says the little motors. That's what I used. I had a whole bunch of them and basically salvaged a lot of motors out of VCRs and CD players. They are reversible motors that, you know, that drive the, load the cartridge in and back, go backwards, pull it out. And in fact, you said the great way the motors can last. If you take, for instance, the head, the video head in a VCR, the bearing that the head rides on, two bearings in there. I pulled a number of parts, took out the small bearings in there, the their similar to like Timken bearings, the roller bearings, these little, they're only about a half inch in diameter with about a quarter of an inch hole in the middle for the shaft. And I've used them a number of applications for my homebrew rotary inductors. And in fact, in my precision key that I built, that's the bearings that they turn on. So you can, stuff you find in the street, you'd be amazed that I could say you find hard drives and computers. It's a treasure chest, many times of small parts. I've saved so many things from really what people were throwing out, junk. Okay, now let me say some more words about the ATU. As Dick said, there's some very complex formulas for doing matching and all, and I know we got spoiled. I know I'm spoiled. Got this all on the computer, and all I have to do is push some keys, and bingo, it all comes up. But basically, what I did to understand the operation of the ATU, basically I had taken measurements of my different loads with my instrument to determine the difference, the my network, you know, my L, my C, my reactance that would involve my capacitance that I was in case of minus J or plus J and all. And they were actually what they do is it's read out in ohms, and that's basically what is translated in the ATU, because it's translating the ohm measurement to, like, for instance, the reactance. Let me see if I can explain it. Let me let it drop. I'll try to explain it a little simpler. Let's say we have a, it comes out to, say, minus, a reactant, a minus J, say, capacitive reactant. And if you were to put it into the formula, you would come out, let's say, to a certain amount of ohms. What it does then is take that and basically, like you would do, use the formula C equals 1 over 2 pi S times X of C. That, if you use that formula, it will convert the ohms into, and then take like this, PF, you know, how many picofarads is, in other words, now it's just a variable density. It's actually transmitting the ohms value into the mechanical sense of the variable condenser. And also, let me drop again. Let's say that the inductance required, the inductance setting, is comes out to, let's say, a certain amount of ohms. It actually is taking those ohms and now converting it by setting the inductance so that it's actually taking the L, which would be X of L over 2 pi F, and converting that into inductance. So you have the actual inductance now in microhenry being set. So that's basically how it works, I think. I hope I'm explaining as easy as possible. Over.
Yeah, I think you're writing down the formula for capacitive reactance in ohms, 1 over 2 pi FC, or the inductance in ohms, 2 pi FL. So you plug in frequency, the number 2 pi, 6.28, and the inductance. If you plug in the inductance in Henry, the answer comes out in ohms, and so on. And put in the frequency in hertz. Put in the frequency in megahertz, and I think the answer comes out in microhenries. But that allows you to start using these formulas for an L network or a pi network for impedance matching. If you read the theory section on the first few chapters of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, it'll give you a little more understanding of this, what Mel and I are talking about, particularly when you read the section on the pi matching networks that are popularly used on transmitting tubes. The pi matching network that converts the output impedance of your transmitting tube, which might be 2,000 ohms, down to 50 ohms, which is the impedance for your antenna. That really is a kind of automatic antenna tuner. So studying the output impedance matching network, the tank circuit of transmitters, and the radio amateur's handbook will give you a lot of understanding of how an antenna tuner works. That's it. It's right there. We'll warn you ahead of time. The math is a little bit heavy, but there's modern-day techniques in which you can get around it with a modern-day handheld computer, handheld calculator, or the right kind of a computer program. This Berkeley program I told you about, impedance match plus Berkeley, you Google that word combination, and the first or second thing that comes up under Google, you click on that program from the Berkeley College, and my goodness, is that thing a time saver. It gives you 16 instantaneous answers. You choose the one that you like the most. KQKEY, KQRIW.
Exactly. In fact, if you've taken a gadget that's been around a lot of years, if you want to measure antenna characteristics, there's the old-fashioned noise bridge that's been around a long time. And the readings you get on it, now if you want to convert them, just as I said, as Dick mentioned that in the beginning of the radio amateur's antenna handbook, they go through this whole procedure. In other words, so you can translate the readings that you've got onto actual figures so you know if it's the